or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Patricia Mary, and for the next hour, I will be reading from the Saturday, Sunday, June 27th, 28th issue of Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the Food and Drink page, How to Grill, Griddle, and Smoke Your Way Through Summer. Outdoor cooking has never been more confusing. What with pellet smokers that call themselves grills and charcoal grills that require electricity, here's what you need to know. And this is by Sal Aslila. If that rusty grill in your backyard has seen better days, be warned, picking a new cooker isn't the straightforward process it once was. Some new charcoal grills, traditionally the cook anything anywhere option, now requires electricity to power internal fans and built-in thermometers. Elsewhere, you might buy a grill, in quotation marks, only to find yourself with a pellet smoker, which has more in common with your indoor oven than a Weber kettle. Consider this your antidote to the marketing speak. I had a clear breakdown of the different outdoor cooking methods to try this summer and the gear you'll need to make it happen. Grilling for the do-it-all party host. To grill is to cook food a few inches above glowing charcoal or a gas flame. But even something that simple can lead to confusion. Manufacturers slap the word grill, in quotation marks, on the packaging of all types of cookers, alongside images of steak with shear marks, even if they don't actually involve shearing over a live fire. With the ability to pummel steaks and vegetables at roughly 700 degrees and to set up distinct hot and cold zones, a charcoal grill is the ultimate multi-tool of outdoor cooking, letting you sear, roast, or smoke. Gas grills heat up faster than charcoal and are easier to control, but they sacrifice some of the smoky flavor that makes live fire cooking so distinct. Food poked over a live wood or charcoal fire inevitably tastes good, says Chef Christopher Costau, co-owner of the Charter Oak, a restaurant in St. Helena, California. The grill is its most pure. It's hard to beat the 22-inch Weber kettle, which looks much the same as it did when your parents cooked hot dogs on theirs. Go for the premium model, which costs $229, less than half the price of the larger 26-inch model, but with the same ash cleaning system that makes cleanup notably easier. And it's the 22-inch original kettle premium charcoal grill from Weber. Grilling the round-the-clock cook. A recent Chipotle ad for the chain's Adobe Chicken advertises the meat as grilled, even as an actor flips the thighs on what appears to be a top flat griddle. A representative of Chipotle said that the chain's chicken is grilled fresh throughout the day on the plancha, a flat cooking service similar to a griddle. Nomenclature aside, it's a smart move from Chipotle. Most consumers probably aren't as moved by griddled chicken, but a griddle, a rectangular slab of hot steel set above gas burners, can actually be the unsung hero of the backyard. Essentially a massive skittle, a good griddle can just as easily turn out pancakes for breakfast, paninis for lunch, or yes, chicken thighs for dinner. For George Maltz, owner of Hamburger America, a restaurant in New York, and the author of the book of the same name. The perfect burger patty is cooked on its own fat as it renders out of the meat. A griddle achieves this effortlessly because the juices have nowhere else to go. You have what I like to call grease as a condiment, and that, with the salt, is where the flavor comes from, he says. The gear. When the brand Solo Stove rethought the traditional rectangular flat-top griddle, replacing it with an oval sandwich of stainless steel and aluminum, the result version addressed two of the griddle's biggest weaknesses: cold spot around the perimeter and surface prone to rust. The downsides? It costs $900 without the stand. The price tag reflects the steel fire's build quality, more like a premium skillet than the basic steel found on most griddles. The lid is also sturdy enough to close while cooking at high temperatures, something that could warp a lesser model's top. And the Solo Stove Steel Fire 30-inch stainless steel griddle and stand goes for $1,200 from Solo Stove. Smoking for the patient and the particular. Pitmasters will tell you that the key to great barbecue isn't a sauce or a rub. It's fire management, specifically maintaining stable combustion for 8 hours or more to capture the pleasing elements of oak, cherry, or hickory smoke as it perfumes the meat's surface. For weekend cooks with other life responsibilities, minding a smoker to hold precise temperatures for hours or even overnight is difficult. Pellet smokers solve that problem. With these cookers, set the internal temperature and the computer takes over, feeding small compressed hardwood pellets into the fire as needed to hold the target heat. Ribs and briskets will still take hours to make and won't have the full smoke flavor of a traditional setup, but for the average home cook, the compromise may be worth it. A pellet cooker is a cheap code that gives you back about 85% of your time, says Joe Zava of Zava's Barbecue outside Dallas, where he opts for the old school route with on-set smokers. The gear. The Traeger, Traeger Westwood, which sells for $700, uses the brand's most budget-friendly computer and has enough great space to handle a couple of rib packs or a pork butt. Once it's connected to Wi-Fi, you can adjust temperatures from your phone while the meat probe tracks internal food temperatures. If you want the bragging rights that comes with minding a fire, the Oklahoma Joe's Bronco, which sells for $500, uses charcoal and wood to smoke barbecue without the help of a computer. Unlike a traditional offset smoker, a barrel allows rendered fat to drip directly onto the hot fire, creating the classic charcoal flavor. Enjoy your summer barbecuing. From the fashion page, one dress or suit, three ways. How to wear black in summer. Don't panic, buy a pastel frock for your garden party or beach soiree. Instead, use seasonal accessories to make trusty basics go the extra mile. And this is by Tasha Green Spice. The opening scenes of Breakfast at Tiffany's teaches us everything we need to know about the range of a black dress. Audrey Hepburn as Holly wears similar dark frocks as she goes from an all-night party to a daytime visit at Sing Sing prison, wrapping her evening accessories of opera gloves and statement necklaces for sensible earrings, an enormous hat, and sunglasses. Voila, night to day. And I should have said swapping her evening accessory. Charlize Theron's recently channeled Hollies by wearing a series of all-black ensembles on the press tour for her film Apex. Theron's stylist, Leslie, pulled from a range of brands including Alexander McQueen, Balmain, Vinci, and Dior, a black men's suit styled with no shirt, only a high ruffled collar. Yes, with the right finishing touches, a little black dress or a trusty black suit can work for most any occasion, even those in the summertime, a season typically associated with wearing white or lots of color. For more inspiration, just look to the spring 2026 runway. Chanel played peekaboo with white details, while black camisoles at Bottega Veneta slyly slipped from the shoulder. How romantic. Of course, a Hollywood movie star wearing black on a red carpet and a model wearing it on a runway are slightly different scenarios than mere mortals sporting the shade to a beach or a garden party. But that doesn't mean it's impossible. In fact, black can go through seasons easily than pastels or florals. It's considered timeless for a reason. So once you have the perfect black dress or tailored suit, creative styling can make it work for all the events on your summer social calendar. Black has a way of commuting that you're dressing for yourself rather than for everyone else, says Alexandra Macon, 44, a former Vogue editor and the founder of Over the Moon, a website for wedding and baby planning. She lives in Charleston, South Carolina, where wearing black can prompt the occasional question. I've been asked if I've been in mourning, she said. The fashion designer Norma Camilli is also known for wearing black to all manner of events. In her view, sticking to what you know and like is the best fashion statement. Women are smart, Camilli, 80, says. It takes a certain inner sense of your own style and style intelligence, she added, but never forfeiting your own spirit in the process. Garden Party Black. Take inspiration from the garden's various blooms while styling your black dress. A beaded clutch or an oversized floral brooch, or both, make the attire seem much more playful. For a suit, high contrast is the name of the game. A white top in an unexpected proportion breaks up the seriousness. A brightly colored lipstick or shoe brings joy, making the outfit really pop. Wearing a black dress to an event on the sand may be a bold choice, but not when you add in mermaid-inspired accessories to make it more whimsical. Seashell-adorned bags, necklaces, and even sandals add a bohemian touch without looking like tourist trinkets. With a suit, go one step beyond adding a fishy accessory and wear a wide-gauge knit instead of a button-down. Though it may seem out of character, black at the beach can make a strong impression. Just ask Fabiola, 27, a sales account executive in Montclair, New Jersey. She wore a billowing black gown accented with a single white rose for her beach proposal, which was featured on Macon's website. I love the idea of choosing something unexpected, says Fabiola. For fancier occasions, black feels more at home, but a dress can be freshened up for the summer season with unexpected details. A delicate belt that looks like joliari, say, or an easy pashmina that can be elegantly tied like a scarf or worn as a cape, depending on your mood. Should you go to the suit route, think about what you can add. Dramatic tasseled earrings, a brooch, a as well as what you can remove, namely the shirt, as long as you won't scandalize your hosts. For listening to the reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Here's an interesting article from the Life and Style page. Dead celebrities' clothes sell for thousands. Do buyers ever really wear them? After splurging on wardrobe items belonging to bygone A-listers, some auction buyers are left wondering what to do with them. And this is by Esther Zuckerman. If you spent around $5,120 on a polka dot tie belonging to Diane Keaton, would you wear it? Curtis Masco intends to. Masco, the 60-year-old founder of Portland Leather Goods, placed the winning bid on the tie last month when Boham's auctioned off clothing owned by the actress, who died last fall. He plans to showcase the tie alongside a really amazing picture of Keaton, he says, and occasionally to wear the darn thing out. It's a retour to find a celebrity's belongings up for sale after they die. But these days, those auctions are making a bigger splash than ever before because of both what goes on the block and the prices items sell for. There has always been a collector's market for celebrity-owned items. The difference now is when something high-profile sells, a lot more people know about it, says Lucy Bishop, who runs a fashion auctioneer, which has recently held multiple sales of pieces belonging to Carolyn Bessette Kennedy, which included a Prada coat that sold for $192,000. The Keaton auction set a record at Boham's for the most registrations for a global sale. Every lot was purchased for a total of $4.2 million. In 2023, Sotheby's auctioned the infamous black sheep sweater worn by Princess Diana for $1.14 million. 2 years later, Jane Birkin's original version of the Hermes bag that bears her name sold for $10.1 million, a record for a handbag sale. This month, Christie's set a record for the most expensive Fendi baguette bag sold at auction, a style owned by Elizabeth Taylor, for the price of $21,590. Some of these wardrobe items end up in museums. Several ensembles in the Keaton auction were acquired by the Museum of the City of New York for its costume and textile collection. One, a custom Ralph Lauren outfit that the actress wore to the 92nd Academy Awards, came with an original sketch and a note from Lauren to Keaton. But others go to fans, begging a question, is it in good taste to actually wear them? Bishop has a balanced view on the matter, she says, noting that as long as the garment is cared for, it can survive wear. But there are exceptions. I would never recommend anyone to wear historically important garments just on the basis that if you wear it, you're at high risk of damaging it, she says. In some cases, like Keaton, the fact that she wore much of the clothes that were auctioned off may make it easier for others to do so. It's more of a wearable thing, says Anna Hicks, head of the private and iconic collections at Boham's, referring to Keaton's wardrobe, which contains luxury designers like Tom Brown alongside fashion brands like H&M. At an exhibition of the items in the recent Boham auction, serious buyers and browsers alike could touch her coats, blazers, and skirts. I think it would be a cool moment to say, I got this Diana Keaton coat, and here I am wearing it on the streets of New York, Hicks added. But not everyone feels similarly. Nacho Cano, a 33-year-old musician in Los Angeles, said that he and his friends got into a moral argument last year when he considered buying pieces from a Julian auction of furniture, neckties, instruments, and other items belonging to David Lynch, who had died months earlier. Some of Cano's pals felt that everything for sale should have been donated to a museum. He went ahead and placed bids anyways, spending more than $3,000 on 13 black hats. Cano split the lot with some of the same people who had reservations about the auction. All of the people who had integrity were also the first people to be like, "I want that hat," Cano said. When he bought the hats, it was not clear if they ever touched the Eraserhead's director's head. But according to Cano, they smelled like cigarettes and an old man garage. He wears one of the two he kept for himself, which to him is quite Lynchian. "I felt like David Lynch is some ways is very counterculture, and I feel like culture says, well, this is a precious thing," he said. Martin Nolan, the co-founder and executive director of Julian's, is well aware of the debates that surround wearing a dead celebrity's clothes. It was Thoreau, a connection brokered by Julian, that led Kim Kardashian to attend the 2022 Met Gala in a dress that Marilyn Monroe wore when she sung Happy Birthday to President John F. Kennedy in 1962. She borrowed it from Ripley's, believe it or not, which had bought the dress at a Julian auction in 2016 for $4.8 million. The moment generated outrage on social media, but Nolan was never too concerned. "We felt very good about it because we felt Kim Kardashian, who we have known for years, is a good client, would never do anything to destroy the dress," she said. A representative for Kardashian did not respond to an email requested for comment. In June, Julian's held another Monroe auction where a Pucci blouse sold for $76,800 and one of her evening gowns sold for $32,000. "Whoever is the winning bidder, they get to choose what they do with the items," Nolan says. "Wearing famous clothing can come at a cost," he added. "Remember, you're just the caretaker, because in years to come, these items will sell for more than you paid for them today." From the arts and entertainment page, these new summer TV shows will be the talk of the beach. Whether you're going to the shore, playing golf, or sitting by the pool, these series are poised to be conversational starters. And this is by Esther Zuckerman and Elin Hillerbrand adaptation set in Nantucket. A young Ellie Woods from Legally Blonde by the Pool. Will Ferrell in character on a putting green. Summer TV this year has all that and more, including a new version of an old favorite and a grimy murder mystery. Here are shows coming out next month to put on your streaming list. The first one is Elle, Elle, where to stream on Amazon Prime Video, which starts July 1st. What to know? It's debatable whether Legally Blonde needs a prequel series, but one is coming anyway, starring Lexi Meintree in the title role, made famous by Reese Witherspoon, one of the show's executive producers. Yet another fish out of water comedy, it's set in the 1990s and follows a teenage Ellie Woods from Los Angeles to grungy Seattle, where her pink wardrobe is just as out of style as it was at Harvard. The next one is The Five Star Weekend, where to stream on Peacock, and it starts July 9th. What to know? Nantucket set novels made Hillerbrand a queen of the beach read. Now her work comes to television, starring Jennifer Garner as Holly's show, a food personality who hosts a getaway with friends from different stages of her life after her husband dies. The stack cast also includes Regina Hall, Gemma Chan, Chloe Sevigny, and Desiree Carden. Little House on the Prairie, where to stream on Netflix, July 9th. What to Know, the latest adaptation of Laurel Ingalls Wilder's novels, introduce an indigenous perspective to the classic pioneer story. The production value is much higher than it was on the famed NBC version from the 1970s and the 80s, but the vibes are just as wholesome. Next one is called Lucky, and you can stream it on Apple TV July 15th. What to Know, Anya Taylor-Joy brings her signature intensity to this limited series, playing a con artist who is pursued by the FBI after her husband, Drew Starkey, absconds with millions of dollars that they stole. In addition to law enforcement, she also has to contend with a criminal enterprise. Its eerie, threatening boss is played by Annette Bening. The Hawk, which is on Netflix and it starts streaming July 16th. Farrell, a master of playing obnoxious, egotistical men who are somewhat still lovable, does that once again in this comedy. He stars as Lonnie Hawkins, a washed-up golfer with spiky blonde hair and a bad attitude. Molly Shannon, Farrell's frequent scene partner on SNL, plays the protagonist's estranged wife. Furious, which is streaming on Hulu on July 27th, What to Know, an intriguing new entry into the lengthy canon of killer series. The show stars Emmy Rossum as an FBI agent who becomes preoccupied with tracking down an erratic female murderer who is played by Lola Predicrew. It comes from Elizabeth Merriweather's creation of buzzy show like New Girl and The Dropout. You're listening to the reading of articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Another article from Life and Style. No hair transplants, pills, or toupees. These men are embracing baldness. They've had enough of hiding under hats and obsessively monitoring hairlines. They're not looking smassy. They're looking bald-maxy. Sorry. If you're a man on the internet in 2026, there's a good chance you've been flooded with ads for ways to help you cling to your hair. Supplements, sprays, and red light masks promise a real result. PRP therapy, a buzzy treatment involving plasma injections into the scalp, can be administered on a lunch break. Countless before and after transplants posts, meanwhile, feature guys who flew to Turkey as sphinx cats and seemingly returned as kings of the jungle. Balding is framed as a disease to get rid of, says Ben Sherry, 27, a lifestyle influencer who works in higher education in San Diego, California. To keep his hair, Sherry tried several methods, finasteride pills, a dermaling device that pricks the scalp to increase blood flow, a toupee, among others, before shaving it all off in April. The video of him doing so has been viewed a million times on Instagram. Once bald, Sherry felt relief and acceptance, he said, along with the sense that it really never was that deep. He is among a cohort of men who have had enough of hiding under hats and obsessively monitoring hairlines. Instead, they're reaching for the clippers and showing off their bald heads, IRL, at festivals and meetups and on social media accounts like Bald Cafe and Bald Brother, where they exchange vulnerable transformation photos and virtual fist bumps. Reddit bald subreddit page is a community's high-fiving, shaka-throwing town square. Founded in 2011, it now has almost 500,000 followers and 1.2 million weekly visitors. The number of interactions on the page so far this year is already 7 times higher than in 2024, according to an analytic company, Sprout Social. Choosing baldness is a natural pushback to the hair transplant boom, says Harry James, the founder of Bald Cafe and a facehead of the moment. Shaving off hair is a proactive, empowering move, added James, 35, who lives in Plymouth, England, and has more than 300,000 followers across YouTube and Instagram. For a lot of guys, balding is the first thing they come up against when they really don't have any control. Hair loss treatments were the fastest growing category in beauty and personal care in 2025, according to research firm Euromonitor, with $192 million in U.S. sales. Today's treatments, especially finasteride and minoxidil, give men a significant chance of maintaining their hair, says Dr. Jerry Shapiro, a professor of dermatology at New York University and director of NYU's Hair Treatment and Research Center. But they must be used indefinitely, he said, stressing that not everything works for everybody. Looks maxing, a trend that has dominated culture conversations involving young men, advocates for the thoroughbred thick hair, a hammer-budgering square jaw, and a steroid-enhanced biceps. Accepting yourself as you are is a preposterous thought. Going bald or bald maxing is the opposite. The refreshing, wholesome resistance movement includes men who found treatments ineffective or who blanched at side effects and costs. Fanicide has been linked to low libido and mood changes in a small number of men. Red light and PRP procedures can run into the hundreds and thousands. Others simply wanted to let nature run its course. Before shaving his head last summer, Robert Capron held a funeral for his hair, where he and some friends lit candles and printed out photos of their best hair days. Then, once the deed was done, I made a TikTok video where I'm like, "Hey, bald people, I hope you embrace me," Capron, 32, said. And they did. Whenever I have a question about self-care, I can depend on a bald elder to set me straight, he added, noting that he mostly finds peers on Reddit and Facebook or at Trader Joe's, where he works. Capon, who is also a musician, was so thrilled with his new community that last summer he organized a bald festival in Philadelphia, where he lives. Advertised on social media, the free event featured bald musicians and stalls from baldness-related brands. Capon expected 60 people to come, but 450 turned up. Show-offs with hair were given bald caps to wear in solidarity. His festive second edition will be held in August. Shaving his head, Capon said, is definitely one of the better decisions I made in my life. Embracing baldness isn't all about inner beauty. Many men who have shared before and after shots on social media look outrageously good post-buzz. After all, shaving remains the cheapest and quickest way to deal with a receding hairline. Nobody isn't getting a date because they're bald, says Mark Minguez, 42, co-owner of Manhattan Barbershop, friend of a barber, who has noticed an increase in men buzzing their heads and completing the look with beards in the last 5 years. Mark, who has rocked the look himself since 2018, says that men often appear younger with buzzed heads than with visibly thinning hair. He also cited a 2012 study by the University of Pennsylvania that found bald men can seem taller. Cue every man in America reaching for the walls. When men asked if they should buzz it off, McGuez often reminds them that Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Jason Statham are two of Hollywood's biggest leading men. James, the bald cafe founder, is also a life and fitness coach, and he noted that shaving the head can spark further transformation. Some men who have done it and get in better shape. Embracing baldness wakes you up to all other stuff you can do, he said. You're like, right, I've done this. What else do I need to get in check? James has heard from men who asked for raises at work or left toxic relationships after shaving their heads. That's not to say letting go of hair is easy. Inspired by men's stories on Bald Cafe, Christian Mocha, 24, got his head shaved in January because his thinning hair had affected his confidence and he wanted to start dating. Minoka, who develops software tutorials in Nashville, says he looks so much better now, but wishes he still had a full head of hair. I think, well, a transplant is always an avenue I could explore. That's not the case for James Stolis, a chemical engineer in Las Vegas who declared independence from his follicles last July 4th by shaving his head on a mountaintop in California. A video captured the moment, receiving 30,000 likes when it was shared on Bald Cafe's Instagram. It's done, says Stolis, 29. I don't need to worry about hair anymore. Here's an article from the Health and Wellness page. I went to a silent retreat for 5 days. It nearly broke my brain. A silent, no phones retreat reveals how disorientating it can be when the mind is cut off from the constant digital input. And this is by Pamela Hall. Imagine being entirely disconnected. No phone, no laptop, no smartwatch, no rings, no pings, no TV, no reading, no journaling, no music, and no talking whatsoever, not even eye contact, as you sit, eat, and stroll mindfully alongside 90 or so strangers for 5 days long. This may sound like the setting for a White Lotus-style murder plot, something best suited to self-satisfied tech bros with their own private mountaintops, or people who enjoy soybean and use hashtag like hashtag mind, body, and soul. Sounds like hell was the most common response I got when describing my plan to head to just such a retreat this month. And yet, that was the draw. Like many people, I spent the bulk of my life following a familiar routine. Could it hurt to pass a few days doing something altogether different? However awful, it would be over soon enough. Meanwhile, I might benefit from a spring cleaning of the brain. After years of downloading meditation apps and constantly ignoring their notification, I might even succeed at meditating. In my favor, though not a Buddhist, I am intellectually, if not spiritually, drawn to Buddhism's doctrine of suffering, impermanence, and non-attachment. I enjoy being alone and often wish people, myself included, would talk less. Not in my favor, I cannot abide hippie culture, bristled at the slightest whiff of woo-woo and balk extensively at the phrase loving kindness, which immediately calls to mind the worst person I know. There was the risk that in trying to achieve mindfulness, I might wind up losing my mind. I've heard of the Insight Meditation Society through several friends, all hardened journo types who come through the other side intact. IMS, they told me, was the real deal. founded in 1976 by Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, and Jack Kornfield, legendary teachers in the tradition of Vipassana, or mindfulness meditation. Located near the Berkshires in Massachusetts, IMS, which is Insight Meditation Society, has welcomed luminaries like the Dalai Lama to its grounds, which include three dormitories, a forest retreat amid acres of well-maintained trails, restaurants or yogas. Pali terms are in heavy rotation in these parts. Follow a strict schedule that starts with a 5:15 a.m. bell and includes three meals between alternating sets of sitting and walking meditation. Vegetarian food is served cafeteria style and is practiced, if not by decree, eaten slowly, putting down the fork between bites. Takeaway, you eat less and enjoy more. Within the niche category of meditation memoir, I've always appreciated natives by type A's, the kind of meditators who start off by sitting in silent judgment. Here is Emil Carey's in his book 2020 book called Yoga, writing about a fellow retreatant. Since I'm a negative sort of person, my attention focused on him. With a pointed goatee and a wine-toned jacquard sweater, he annoyingly smug in the role of the smiling, benign sage, rich in insights into chakra alignment and the benefits of letting go. Personally, I couldn't figure out how to size up other yogis by without getting caught in a eye contact, but I did notice recurring characters. A runner-up in the Philip Seymour Hoffman look-alike contest, a woman who accidentally served herself lunch before the official chime as everyone looked on in horrified silence, a couple of extroverts visibly straining not to gestate or emit the occasional whispered nicety. Speaking was officially permitted during small group meetings led by the retreat teachers Annie Nugent and Devin Barry. These sessions, along with daily Dhamma talks, both of which I dreaded, turned out to be the retreat's highlights. The teachers were wise, down-to-earth, funny, and dare I say, enlightening. Barry jokingly referred to him as a representative of Big Dharma. I came ready to roll my eyes and found myself riveted. I could have listened for hours and may do so in the future on the Dharma Seed website, and it's spelled Dharma Seed website, which offers many of these recorded talks free. My low point came on the second day when I set out at 9 a.m. for what I figured would be a 90-minute walk. Following the advice of a friend who had drawn a rough map of his favorite trails before I left, I took the longer route. At some point, I must have deviated from the path. But who knows? The map was back on my locked-away phone. Before long, I had entered a state wildlife preserve. I spent the next 3 hours profoundly lost. When I finally emerged onto an unfamiliar road, I staggered up to two people standing by a lumber yard and, in a few words as possible, asked how I got to get back to IMS. It was another 5-mile walk back. Lunch had been served hours earlier. Cookies exalted the chalkboard menu, the sole dessert offered during the entire retreat. I experienced much pain as I spied cookies remained inside the compost bin. The worst of it, aside from the momentary panic in the woods, bears, no water, no food, no GPS, was that it was if it had not happened. I couldn't reassure anyone by saying, I made it, because no one knew who I was, never mind that I had been missing for 6 hours. There was no salvage trace to show how I had gone astray. Apart from GPS and the weather app, I didn't miss my phone nearly as much as I anticipated. In its absence, I recognized that I mostly turned into it out of boredom, idleness, or almost inert curiosity. For 5 entire days, I had no idea what Donald Trump was saying or what had happened in the Middle East. As it turned out, I missed a lot and nothing at all. I did miss TV and novels, narrative fantasies, creative expression, all of which, in meditation practice, are considered distractions. Meditation involves maintaining awareness only of the current moment. When your mind wanders, whether to rehearse a future argument or ruminate over what you said Friday night, you are meant to note it lightly and without judgment. Thinking or planning. Actively trying to dismiss these things was exhausting. My days transformed to where does the time go to why won't the time go? Bored into slumber by 8:30 or 9, I woke instantly to the bell at 5:15. I learned that under certain conditions, chopping vegetables, the volunteer service I signed up for, can be a source of deep engagement and satisfaction. I don't think I meditated particularly well, although I did sit entirely still for 45-minute long stretches. I triumphed for this restless person. I learned a lot from the teachers and left eager to read more deeply into Buddhist texts. In the days that followed, I felt calmer and less reactive. I did not get anywhere close to enlightenment and likely will never will, but I believe in trying. Before you go, rewatch The Matrix. Turn out the red pills is also a metaphor for awakening. Read Robert Wright's Why Buddhism is True, The Science and the Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment for a secular grounding in Buddhist practice. Pack good walking shoes, emergency sugar if you'll know you'll miss it. Consider cheating. You aren't supposed to, but I packed a couple of books, unexciting ones about Buddhist philosophy and nature, only to do so if you can accept that this is not the way. You are listening to the reading and articles and features from Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Another article from the Life and Style. When did the first day of work outfit become so casual? Some young workers are ditching the dress to impress ritual for their first day, swapping blazers and heels for oversized clothing and leisure wear. And this is my Maura Ranigan. Daylin Ray showed up her first day of work in her favorite jeans, a white t-shirt, a cardigan, and thrift brown boots. She'd been told the dress code was casual cute and felt her outfit delivered. You only have so many first days and wanted to look good and feel cute, says Ray, 22, a Michigan State University graduate who started a new role in influencer management in April. Traditional professional office clothing doesn't make me feel that way. The first day of work outfit has long been a carefully choreographed ritual, the professional equivalent of a firm handshake. Now, across industry and cities, it has undergone a transformation as Gen Z's entered the workplace, arriving on day one in oversized silhouettes, gym-ready fabrics, and leisure wear looks not long ago would have raised eyebrows in any workplace. When Ray dresses for their office these days, whether she looks professional is an afterthought, she said. She cares more about factors like the weather and if she's going to happy hour afterwards. In December, she posted a TikTok showing off her oversized crew neck and pajama-like black trousers, playfully capturing putting the casual in business casual. The video drew more than 1.8 million views. My outfit doesn't reflect how professional I am, she says. My work does. Kara Brennan Alamo, a former chief people officer at Latest, a human resource platform, has noticed new hires dressing more casually across her client base in text, finance, and beyond. Things are more casual than they were 5 years ago, she says, but norms are being reestablished in real time. In traditional white-collar professions such as corporate law, investment banking, or politics, dressing formally has always been the standard. Alamo noted that professional colleagues in finance have recently started putting what to wear back into onboarding sessions for new employees, a sign that the casualization has gone far enough to warrant a correction. Previous generations, including millennials, aimed to blend in at work to signify difference and willingness to conform to the company culture, says Casey Lewis, a journalist and trend researcher who writes about Gen Z's workplace habits. It was a little bit more than showing up on time, do what asked of you, hard work, and be quiet, Lewis, 38, said. Younger generations are challenging that idea, and their clothing choices reflect their changing professional values. For them, individuality is free expression rather than rebellion. Dress codes be damned, Lewis says. They're also more skeptical of authority. A 2025 Deloitte survey found that fewer than 1 in 10 members of Gen Z say their primary career goal is reaching a leadership position. According to a 2025 Gallup report, only 46% of employees feel clear about what is expected of them at work, down from 56% in 2020, with Gen Z reporting some of the steepest declines in employee engagement of any generation. Work takes up such a huge part of your life, and Gen Z doesn't want to split themselves into a work version and a real version, says Ano Keiko, a Gen Z fashion influencer and trend forecaster on TikTok. She pointed out that anxiety about job security has led some young people to prioritize differentiating themselves at work. A 2025 Harvard Kennedy School survey found that 59% of young Americans view AI as a threat to their job prospects. A 2024 report from the American Staffing Association found that 37% of Gen Z workers are worried about being laid off, compared with just 11% of baby boomers. There's much stronger awareness of how replaceable you can be as an employer. On TikTok, hundreds of thousands of videos are tagged hashtag workoutfit or office style, often showing outfits dreamed up by people who never had to sit through a performance review. The information young workers are seeing online about what's office appropriate is not coming from HR, but from creators who are just trying to go viral, Lewis says. The blurred expectations come after the pandemic has collapsed the boundary between home and office before most members of the Gen Z has ever stepped but in a workplace. Beverly Hart, 32, who works in public policy and previously worked in government affairs, says that ambiguity about the new normal has created an in-between problem of how people dress for work, not full suits, but not hoodies either. There's a real struggle to define what business casual even means today, Hart says. For her first day working on Capitol Hill in 2017, she wore a white button-down, black pencil skirt, black blazer, black heels, and a standard-issue uniform for 20-somethings who watched too much West Wing growing up, she said. Her current job is based in Brooklyn, satirically a world away. If I showed up in that outfit now, she said, people would assume I had traffic court or something after work. Pulling off a sharp outfit on day one buys capital to dress down later, says Allison Elias, the author of The Rise of Corporate Feminism and an assistant professor of business administration at the Darden School of Business at the University of Virginia. Even if the boss of your tech company or app startup is wearing a hoodie, she said, show up in sweats before you established a reputation for competence and you're starting from a deficit. Cameron Askey, 23-year-old, recent Penn State graduate, wanted to look extra polished on her first day as branded content strategist in New York. She wore a long skirt from Adidas, a collared blue tank, a belt, and loafers. Loser rules don't mean no rules, she says. You wouldn't wear pajamas to a wedding. You have been listening to the reading of articles and features from Saturday, Sunday, June 27th, 28th issue of Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal. We read from Off Duty every Saturday now at 8 p.m. Your reader has been Patricia Mary. Thank you for listening. God bless and be safe out there.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have Sports Illustrated. And at 10 o'clock on this Independence Day, we have a three-hour old-time radio special with six episodes of The Bob Hope Show. Stay with us. The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability